On this edition of Celebrating Science, Neil Turok on What Banged. Brought to you by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, an independent, nonprofit scientific research and education outreach organization, home to a growing cluster of international scientists who contemplate and calculate new ideas about the very essence of space, time, matter, and information. Perimeter Institute also offers a wide array of educational outreach activities for students, teachers, and members of the general public in order to share the joys of scientific research, discovery, and innovation.
Tonight, the very compelling talk, What Banged, with Professor Neil Turok of Cambridge University, where he is the chair of mathematical physics. He is also the director of the Center for Theoretical Cosmology in Cambridge. Dr. Turok earned his PhD at Imperial College and later was professor of physics at Princeton University. He and his group have researched aspects of cosmic background radiation, which were later confirmed in detail. His team also developed a key test for the presence of the cosmological constant, also recently confirmed. With Stephen Hawking, he developed the Hawking-Turok solutions regarding the birth of inflationary universes. More recently, with Paul Steinhardt at Princeton, he has been developing a cyclic model for cosmology, which is detailed in their popular book, Endless Universe. I'm also happy to report that Professor Turok is one of the newest members of Perimeter Institute's own Scientific Advisory Committee, our top scientific oversight body comprised of highly esteemed researchers drawn from the international physics community. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to Canada, to Waterloo, and to Perimeter Institute, Dr. Neil Turok.
The topic I'm going to talk about involves thinking about the universe and trying to develop mathematical models of it. But all that really is trying to be intellectually as honest as we can. In other words, we try to make the most detailed and consistent models that we can. We try to prove them wrong, either mathematically or logically, or even better, through observations. And it's a very fun and exciting enterprise. And for me personally, it's actually the best way we have of appreciating and enjoying this fantastic universe we find ourselves in. And so the title of my talk is actually stolen. I grew up in Africa, and I had a marvelous primary school teacher there, a math teacher, a Scottish lady who volunteered to teach in Africa, and she got me interested in math and science. When I finally became a professor in Cambridge and I was on a TV show, she then wrote to me. She said, "Are you the same Neil Turok that I used to teach when you were 9 years old in Dar es Salaam in Tanzania?" And literally, I was jumping up and down because to reconnect after such a long period. And she'd always been my, you know, favorite teacher of all time. So now I keep in touch with her regularly. And about a year ago, I went up to Edinburgh where she lives. She's over 80 now. And she said, "You know, what do you do?" And I was trying to explain about cosmology, and we struggle with how galaxies formed and all that. She said, "Neil," in a strong Scottish accent, which I can't really reproduce, she said, "Neil, there's only one thing which I want to know the answer to, and that's what banged." Everyone talks about the Big Bang this, the Big Bang that, and every time a speaker comes to Edinburgh and gives a public lecture, I always put my hand up, "What banged?" And I've never had an answer. So, in her honor, my lecture is going to be called What Banged. And these are some of the people I work with. One of the wonderful things about cosmology is it's truly an international field, and we are we collaborate with people all around the world because people all around the world want to know what banged. Let me begin with an equation, but don't worry, I'm not going to deal with this equation. I want to explain why I got interested in theoretical physics. Theoretical physics is an utterly remarkable subject in that we can write down in one line all the known laws of physics. Okay, so this is everything we know about nature at a basic level. Well, it is. It summarizes all the laws we know of which govern nature at the most basic level. And you'll see lots of famous names there. But I think it's kind of remarkable that we can write it down in one line. Now, admittedly, this is in a very compact notation. And so, for example, there are actually 18 free parameters in this equation, which are sort of buried in the notation, because that lambda over there is actually a matrix, has lots of numbers in it. So this is not the final story. But the fact we can write this down in one line, and this explains millions of experiments conducted every day of the week at particle physics colliders and so on. This equation summarizes an unimaginably large amount of data with only 18 free parameters. So it's a fantastic achievement of 20th century physics. It's not the final story, because what fixed those 20 numbers? So as a kid interested in math and physics, you know, when I learned that actually there is a unified description of the world, and it's so elegant and beautiful and powerful, that's very attractive to try to take the next step. So this is the way often people present this. It's all implicit in the previous equation, but this is another sort of complementary point of view. There are all these particles. There are 90 particles called fermions, and that's Dirac on the right. And then there are 30 particles called bosons, and they're connected with the forces through which all the first set of particles interact. And do you know who that is? Maxwell. There are a few loose ends, which we'll get to. So when I say all the particles and forces, that's almost true, but there's a little matter of dark matter, which we still don't know what it is, and dark energy, even more mysterious. The equation I wrote down, that one equation, not only describes the particles and the forces through which the particles interact, it actually describes the whole arena within which they interact. And that occurs through Einstein's theory of gravity. And there's Einstein's equation, in which matter on the right-hand side, the T mu nu, curves space-time on the left-hand side. The G mu nu is the curvature of space-time. So using those laws, we have not only been able to describe every experiment conducted to date, but also the universe itself. And this is the picture which emerged starting in the, well, over the course of the 20th century, but which became very firm after the mid-60s. And the picture is that the universe we see somehow began in a big bang, with lots of question marks. What came out of it is hot radiation and particles, quarks. And these quarks then stuck together to make nucleons, neutrons and protons. Neutrons and protons stuck together to make nuclei, atomic nuclei. And these nuclei then made atoms, which clumped together in clouds of gas. And the clouds of gas then collapsed to make stars, galaxies, black holes, and all of the structures we see around us. So this is a remarkably successful picture, and there is almost no one working in cosmology who does not believe that this is basically correct. So just to fast forward, and I'm going to just ignore large amounts of data and evidence for that picture, because I want to get back to the beginning. So to jump forward to 2001, in 2001, there was a huge advance made in the subject by this satellite, which was launched and which sits out at L2, a special point opposite the sun. The satellite orbits around the sun with the Earth, spinning as it goes and scanning the sky. And this is the map that it made. So it's simply measuring the radiation coming to us from the sky and coming from the Big Bang. And so this picture represents the universe as it was about 300,000 years after the Big Bang. So this is our oldest fossil record of the universe. Up above is a picture made in 1992 by the Cosmic Background Explorer satellite, also a NASA mission. And as you can see, that shows some level of patchiness, but not well resolved. So that was the discovery of the patchiness in the background radiation. The WMAP picture really shows it to us in very fine detail. And next year, a satellite called Planck is going to, the Planck satellite, named after Max Planck, is going to show us in much finer detail still. So we're very lucky as people to be living at the time when the structure of the whole universe was discovered. Okay, this is it. And how does theory compare with reality? Well, you can predict from that picture. So in that picture, you see a patchiness and you see structures of various scales. And roughly speaking, the characteristic size of one of these cold or hot spots is about a degree. And so mathematically, what you do is a process called a Fourier transform, and you plot the amplitude, the strength of the fluctuations, against angular scale. And the angular scale actually goes backwards, so down here is large angles, and down there is small angles. And you see this big peak in the fluctuation level at around 1 degree. Now, the red curve here was worked out in the early 1970s on the basis of Einstein's theory of gravity and plasma physics, a very well-established physics. And so this curve was anticipated the data by 30 years. Okay. So, and it's simply astonishing the level of agreement between the data and the theory. So these laws of physics, which were inferred simply from the solar system and experiments in the solar system, really do extend to the whole universe. And that's a very surprising fact. There's nothing weird out there. Well, there's some weird things out there, but not very weird. There's limited weirdness out there. I was very lucky that in the early 90s, when I got interested in this kind of physics and these calculations, nobody had actually calculated one of the main signals, which was the polarization of the sky, because light can not only have an intensity, it can have a polarization. If you look at it with polarized sunglasses, then as you tilt the sunglasses, you can see a different intensity, and that's a sign of polarized light. And so we calculated what is the correlation between the temperature and the polarization. In other words, if I see a hot spot on the sky, what will the polarization look like around it? And that's shown in this graph down here. So these were our calculations, the red curve, and the data lies on it beautifully. Now, it's sort of a funny thing, because you do this calculation, we're using standard physics, which we believe, and you get the right answer. So it's a little bit disappointing in a way, because what have you learned? You just have more confidence that standard physics was right. And all the equations we used, we didn't invent. These were Einstein's theory. Chandrasekhar worked out all the plasma transport equations. And so what do you say? Well, that's the way the world works. Well, so far, all the observations are consistent with a rather simple universe. The universe is spatially flat, and that means that it's like XYZ geometry. When we do geometry in class, and we use Pythagoras' theorem and so on, we're assuming what's called Euclidean geometry. and that's called spatially flat geometry, the simplest type of geometry. And the universe is consistent with that, even though Einstein's theory allows it to be curved. On top of that flat, smooth geometry, we have some density variations, and those density variations lead to a distortion of space-time itself, small distortions of space-time. And this is slightly technical, but the way we talk about these perturbations, I call them glassy perturbations. Glassy stands for following properties. Gaussian random field is like the normal distribution in statistics. It's the simplest kind of distribution. Linear, small amplitude, like waves on the sea, ripples on the sea. Adiabatic means that the makeup of the universe does not vary from place to place. The same proportions of ordinary matter, radiation, neutrinos, and dark matter are found everywhere. The ratios are constant across all of space, even though the density varies. Scalar, this means that, as another technical word, it's just the density varies, there isn't any shear. If you study mechanics, you know there are all these different ways you can stretch or deform a medium. Well, it's only the overall density that changes. We don't have shear. Scale invariant, again, it's the simplest possible kind of fluctuations where the level of variations of density in the early universe are the same on all scales. So if I look at the universe on 1 centimeter at some time, the early universe, the density will vary by about 1 part in 100,000. And now if I look at it on the scale of a megaparsec, you know, a hugely bigger scale, it still varies by 1 part in 100,000. And that's what we mean by scale invariant. So these glassy perturbations, the simplest kind of perturbations, are what we actually see coming out of the Big Bang. But there's some big puzzles. One of which is that most of the matter in the universe isn't made out of atoms or ions. Most of it's in dark matter. So 5% is in ordinary matter, 25% is in dark matter, and as we'll see, 70% is in dark energy. So this is, now the dark matter you can actually see. Even though it doesn't interact with light at all, the way you see it is exactly as you see water in a glass. So if I water is transparent, but I can easily see it. If you pour water into a glass, you can see the water. And the way you see it is because it bends light. So the dark matter does the same thing. And what's happening here is a cluster of galaxies. And behind that cluster of galaxies is a blue galaxy in this shape. So it's sitting behind that clump. And the clump of galaxies behaves like a set of droplets of water. You know, if you sit in the bath and you have water droplets on your fingers and you hold them up to the light, you'll see an image in each drop of the light behind. Well, that's the same phenomenon here, that the lumpy distribution of dark matter acts like a bunch of water droplets, and each water droplet is generating one of these images and of the same galaxy behind. And this picture shows the reconstructed picture of the galaxy as it is before being lensed. And you can see it's the same galaxy. So we know there's dark matter. We can even see it using the fact that it's causing this lensing. And then 70% is in dark energy. So here's a picture of dark energy. made at vast expense. dark energy is very strange stuff. It's the energy of the vacuum. It's the energy of empty space. And it has very weird and important properties. One of which is that only gravity cares about the dark energy. If this room had some amount of dark energy, meaning there's some energy per unit volume of stuff, of the vacuum, and I do any physics experiment at all, then I actually don't care about the dark energy because it's there before and it's there afterwards. So if you think about conservation of energy, it just cancels before and after, it's always there. So you can just disregard it. So there is no physics that cares about the dark energy except gravity, because gravity responds to all the energy, including the dark energy. The other weird property of dark energy is that it is boost invariant, meaning if you run very fast, it's exactly the same. Okay, so normal materials, if you run very fast and then you hit them, like if I run very fast into that door, there's a lot of energy, or if a car comes and hits me very fast, it makes a big difference. If it's going slowly, there's not much effect. If going fast, there's a huge effect because it has all this kinetic energy. Now, dark energy is exactly the same no matter how fast you go. We call it boost invariant. You can fly as close as you like to the speed of light, and the dark energy is exactly the same. And that property of this boost invariant means that it's completely different to ordinary matter. And in particular, it leads to a repulsive gravitational field. The dark ordinary matter attracts under gravity, well, dark energy repels. And that can cause it to blow up the universe. And in fact, that's what the observations indicate, that there's a certain level of dark energy in space. And right now, that dark energy is coming to dominate over or has come to dominate over ordinary matter and dark matter. And what it will do in the future is blow up the universe, dilute everything else away, and completely take over. So our future will be dominated by this dark energy. And all the galaxies will be diluted away to negligible levels. So this was a big surprise when it was discovered in the late 90s, and then now a number of complementary lines of evidence which support this picture. Here's a picture of the person who first understood this capacity of dark energy to blow the universe up. And it's Professor De Sitter. And this is a picture from a Dutch newspaper in 1930. And so here's De Sitter in the shape of a lambda. And lambda is the technical symbol used for dark energy. And he's blowing up the universe. In fact, Einstein himself tried to use the dark energy, or lambda, to make a static universe. Because Einstein thought the universe, it didn't make sense for the universe to be expanding. He thought the universe must have been here forever. He didn't believe that it would have a beginning. And so Einstein made a model where he balanced the repulsion of dark energy against the attraction of matter to have a static universe that would last forever. Unfortunately, it was unstable, because if it contracted a little, the matter became more dense and then contracted more. If it expanded a little, then the dark energy won, and it expanded more. So it wasn't a sensible universe, but that was Einstein's first attempt at a cosmology. So there's the puzzle of dark matter and the puzzle of dark energy, but there's an even bigger puzzle, which I've already alluded to, which is that the universe seems to have begun 13.7 billion years ago. And what does that mean? In physics, we don't really have any notion of the beginning of time. I mean, what is the beginning of time? So the conventional assumption, which has become very popular in the field, is sort of to ignore this problem. It's to say, well, we don't understand the beginning, but let's just assume that when the universe sprang into existence, it must have done so full of some kind of energy which would blow it up, which would cause it to expand. We do know it was very dense at early times. So if you want something to blow it up, you have to make that even denser so that it overwhelms all the matter and radiation and it causes the universe to blow up. So the conventional assumption is to assume the universe started out full of this kind of energy like dark energy, called inflationary energy. But it's basically a very high density version of lambda, the one we observe today. It has the same effect of causing exponential growth, but its density has to be a Google times greater. So that's the conventional picture of the Big Bang. It doesn't explain the beginning, it just assumes the universe came into existence full of dark energy. So we draw this in a graph. This is the amount of inflationary energy. It's the energy density per unit volume is the vertical axis. And phi, along the horizontal axis, is some quantity. We call it a field, but it's basically some quantity at each point in space which can take different values. And according to those different values, you can have more or less dark energy at each point in space. So the assumption is we have this, and the dynamics of phi are very much like a ball rolling down a hill. The curve here is the potential energy for phi. And so the assumption is that for some reason, some quantity started out in the universe such that the dark energy was huge, that the inflationary energy was huge. Okay, so phi starts out over here, the ball's up the hill, every point in space is suddenly has lots and lots of inflationary energy, and it blows up. And then the picture is, this stuff has to go away, so it runs down the hill and ends at the bottom, and releases its energy into radiation and matter. And then this exponential expansion driven by the inflationary energy comes to an end. So that's the conventional picture. And it has a very beautiful aspect, which is that this dark energy, as it rolls downhill and the energy density decreases, doesn't do it in a completely smooth way. Like everything else in the universe, it undergoes quantum uncertainty. According to quantum mechanics, nothing is ever fixed. This phi is no different. And so there's some quantum jitter in this field. And what that means is different parts of space will have a different trajectory downhill, and you'll end up with a different amount of density being released into matter and radiation. And so that leads to density variations. So this inflationary picture, as well as blowing up the universe, making a big smooth universe like the one we see, it also generates the density variations, which we need to explain the formation of galaxies and stars, because you have to have an inhomogeneous universe where the density varies in order to collapse and make structures. Now, I'm just going to give a sort of one line. So why does this lead to scale invariant density? And the reason has to do with exponentials. And I'm sorry if this is sort of too mathematical, but here is the way we measure distances in the universe. This is called a line element. And I just want to point out one thing, which is that in an inflating universe, space is growing exponentially. And an exponential of time has the property that if I shift time by a fixed amount, then this quantity changes by a constant. Okay, so if I ask what is happening at each moment of time, if I run forward in time, you can compensate that by scaling space back. There's a symmetry of the space-time. If I advance the clock by 1 second and rescale my lengths by that exponential factor, then it's the same. And because of that symmetry, when you trace through the equations, scale invariance comes out, because all scales are the same. The physics on every scale is actually the same. So there's a nice explanation for why the pattern we see in the sky is scale invariant initially. By the way, I should say that when you see that oscillating curve, it doesn't look very scale invariant. But that's a sort of post-processing of the universe coming about from oscillations of the plasma. The primordial density variations are, as far as we can tell, were scale invariant. So here we have this model, which has been developed over the 20th century, called a concordance model, because most people agree with it. and the model assumes that the universe sprung into existence, underwent inflation, and then the hot plasma cooled, the universe became transparent, and then stars and galaxies and all these structures formed, and there's WMAP over there measuring the outcome. But as I want to emphasize, this part is very mysterious. So there are a few puzzles here. One is the beginning. Is that really sensible to have the universe begin? Can we describe the beginning? What is the inflationary energy? As I've said, there isn't really a good explanation for that. It just has to be put in by hand in the model. Why did the universe start out inflating? Why didn't it start out here? That's not explained. And then there's a lot of tuning of the model you have to do. It turns out that to make the model work, you need the inflationary energy density to be 10 to the 100 times larger than the dark energy today. So that's a pretty bad if you have to put a huge number into your model like that without any rhyme or reason. And then there's the singularity, that if we trace time back to the beginning, this point here is a point where the density of the universe is infinite, all of space is at one point, and all of our equations fail disastrously. Okay, so all of physics really fails there in the most extreme possible way. Now, there is a theory of a beginning, and again, this is slightly mathematical, but it won't last long. Stephen Hawking and Jim Hartle in the 80s developed a rather clever way of trying to begin the universe. And the way they do it is using complex numbers. Square root of minus one is I. And there's a trick you can use, whereas if you take an object or a space which has only space dimensions and no time, then if you say one of those space dimensions becomes imaginary, it goes, we say in the complex plane, it goes up the imaginary axis. Then it turns out you get a minus sign, because so here, if theta is an angle on a four sphere, then I say that this angle becomes imaginary. It acquires an I. And pictorially, this is, yeah, I'll explain the picture in a moment. Then theta squared gives you an I squared, which is a minus one, and now that's time. So it's basically a mathematical trick for turning time into space. So the picture of their picture of the universe is that here is time running vertically up this picture. And so I have a universe, like a sphere, which is blowing up in time. And then their idea was that at some moment of time, actually, time turns into space. And before that period, I really do have a sphere. And so this is a way of sort of rounding off the beginning of the universe in a smooth way, such that the equations are still valid. It's just that you have to go down the imaginary axis. So time goes back along the real axis, and then it goes imaginary in their picture. It's a very beautiful and clever mathematical picture, but it has one big problem, which is that it makes a prediction. And the prediction is that the universe starts at the bottom. Prediction of that picture is that the universe starts here, okay, by an exponentially large probability. Very, very unlikely to start up the hill. So after working with Stephen Hawking for a few years on this picture, I mean, I liked it because it was predictive, but unfortunately the prediction was wrong. So I started looking for other possible explanations for the Big Bang. And the logical place to turn to was this theory called M theory, which is an outgrowth of string theory. And I thought I'd just give you a very quick, extremely rough picture of what this theory is. So the basic principle in string theory is that everything in the world is described by strings. So here's a string. It's a line. It's a flexible object. It's like Einstein's picture of space-time as a flexible substance that can distort. String theory is the same thing, but in lower dimensions. So there's only one dimension of space on a string, and then the string travels through time. And to show you how this explains the particles we see in a very economical and beautiful way, think of a little piece of string with two ends. It spins end on end, okay? Turns out the ends have to move at the speed of light. So the string is spinning around, and now it can actually move perpendicular to the plane it's spinning in. And that spin is exactly the spin of a photon. A photon is polarized. And a photon has two polarization states, and the spin, we say it's spin one, and the photon has a spin, and it's just the spin of the string that makes the photon. Well, what about a graviton? Well, if you can make a photon, what you can do is join two of them, just glue two of them together, and delete the ends. So now it's just a closed loop, which in the form of a doubled line. And that's a graviton. And obviously it has spin two, because just two photons. So it's just a picture of how economical this theory is, and how from trying to model a photon and light, you immediately get gravity for free. It's really, it's very clever. Not in M theory, you get membranes, two-dimensional surfaces like soap bubbles, which can vibrate in various ways. You can even have three brains, which are flexible structures with three space dimensions, like space, like the space we live in, and more. In this theory, it turns out, for mathematical reasons, you have to have seven more dimensions of space than the ones we observe. So even though it looks to us like the world is three-dimensional, length, height, and breadth, actually at every point in this room, there are more dimensions of space, seven in all. And this is what they look like. So if I thought of this room as a table, two-dimensional table, then at every point on this table, there would be some extra dimensions twisted up in a little ball. Six of them are curled up like that. And the intriguing thing is that the size and shape of that little ball of extra dimensions, which exists at every point in space that we're aware of, their size and shape actually fixes all the constants of nature. It fixes the mass of the electron, the electric charge. It fixes all the other parameters in the very first equation. All those 18 parameters, they're fixed by this. So even though it doesn't solve the problem of explaining those numbers, it changes the problem to another problem. It just says those numbers are a reflection of the structure of the universe. Except it's not the universe we see, it's the hidden universe. So it's changed the problem, and that's good, because maybe now you can solve it, because you've got a very different picture. And so the remarkable thing about this is that particle physics, the science of all the particles and forces in nature, is just another branch of cosmology. The particle physicists were not aware of this. Okay? They thought they were measuring all the particles and forces, but actually what they're doing is mapping the extra dimensions of space within this theory. The seventh dimension is even more peculiar. The seventh dimension, and I should say this picture is only true in one of the most elegant versions of M theory. There are other versions. But in this version, the seventh dimension is a gap between two three-dimensional worlds. So here's one three-dimensional world. Here's another three-dimensional world. There's a tiny gap between them called the bulk, which is 10 to the power minus 15 of the size of a nucleus, atomic nucleus. So it's very, very tiny, okay, this gap. But basically, this is the world has a structure of like a giant capacitor with two parallel worlds living very close together. The existence of this extra dimension explains the weakness of gravity compared to the other forces, why left-handed particles are not the same as right-handed spinning particles. But the reason I got interested in this is because it also could explain how the density of the universe was finite at the bang. So if you have a picture where the whole universe came out of a point, no mathematics is ever going to explain that, because you can't possibly have an equation describing how everything emerges from a structureless single point. But if the density of the universe was finite at the Big Bang, then it's possible that there's an equation which describes that. I'll show you how the density is finite. In this picture, the Big Bang is not all of space coming out of a point. The Big Bang is just a collision between these two three-dimensional worlds which live back to back. And so here's a little movie of this. The gap has been enormously expanded so that you can see it. So these planes, each plane represents a three-dimensional world separated from its neighbor by the fourth dimension of space across the gap. And this is how it evolves. If those two brain worlds, three-dimensional brain worlds, collide, they release matter and radiation, and then matter and radiation expand, dark energy takes over, and when dark energy takes over, it dilutes away the matter and radiation and flattens out the brains again. When they pull together, they do not remain perfectly flat and parallel. In fact, the assumption in this model is that there's a weak attractive force, and that force is what generates the ripples. And one of the surprising things we found in this model is that you could generate scale invariant density variations in this picture. So this was an alternative to inflation. And I won't dwell on this, but basically in the cyclic picture, the world is cyclic. You can have a bang followed by galaxy formation, dark energy takes over. The dark energy, in fact, causes these two worlds to attract. And there's another bang, more radiation, galaxies, and so on. And that compares to the inflationary picture in which the world begins and evolves in a linear manner until the dark energy takes over, and that's the end of the story. In the standard picture, the world starts without an explanation, and then it ends in nothing. It ends in dark energy. So these are very, very different pictures of the universe. And there are some advantages of this cyclic model. You don't need inflation, is one. Dark energy has a role. In fact, it drives the whole cycling. And it creates the density variations. Another advantage is that maybe there's an explanation for why the extra dimensions take the size and shape they do. Because their size and shape influences what happens at the bang itself. It's crucially important what the extra dimensions are doing at the bang. So maybe if they're in the wrong configuration, you do not go through. And in particular, one can imagine as the cycling continues, the extra dimensions settle down to a particular stable state. And this allows you to imagine a dynamical selection for all the constants of nature. Maybe the size and shape of the extra dimensions are fixed by repeated cycles of evolution of the universe until it settles down into a stable cycling state. Recently, I want to tell you about some very sort of recent work we've been doing based on a picture called holography. This is an entirely new tool for studying gravity, which was developed first about 10 years ago. And it's very, very powerful, and we still don't fully understand it. But the theory is the following, that you can take a chunk of space-time, which I've indicated as the interior of a cylinder here. So the interior is the space-time. And what Maldacena argued and gave evidence for, and subsequently there's been lots more evidence for it, what he showed was that anything which happens in that region of space-time can be described by a theory without any gravity, which lives on the boundary of the space-time. We say that's dual. They're just two descriptions of the same physics. So for example, I could send some matter in, watch it collapse and make a black hole, watch the black hole evaporate away by Hawking radiation. I could study that using gravity, or I could just study it using the boundary theory. Now these two people, Thomas Hertog will be here tomorrow, again participating in this workshop, they showed how you can use this setup to actually allow this patch of space-time to collapse to a singularity. And so you have the usual picture of gravity with a collapsing universe, which you now map onto the boundary, and then you study the description on the boundary of the collapsing universe. And the question is, what happens next? And so that's a subject of our very recent research. So it turns out this boundary theory is described by a potential which goes off to minus infinity. Okay, so that looks scary at first, but in fact it has to be scary because it's describing gravity. And gravity is really unlike all the other forces of nature. And the way in which this works, I can explain as follows. So imagine classically, just classical physics, I come to the edge of a cliff, okay, like this stage. So send a particle towards the end of the cliff. But imagine that the drop there is infinite. Okay, that there's a long way down. Well, classically, the particle's perfectly happy. It sails over the cliff and into the abyss. And the abyss is like the singularity. It's where things go to minus, things go to infinity. What happens in quantum theory? In quantum theory, if a particle comes along and sees an infinite cliff, it turns around, goes backwards. That's really the case. And so that happens in this model. So I'll show you this. A quantum particle hits a wall. Now, actually, for quantum mechanically, it doesn't matter if the wall is positive or negative. The behavior is the same. So here, a quantum particle doesn't exist at one point in space. It exists everywhere in space with some probability. So basically, this quantum particle is sending out feelers all the time, which are detecting what's happening in space, over all of space. So here's our quantum particle, and it's really spread out in space, and there's the wall. And I've drawn it positive, but it doesn't matter. If it was negative, it would be just the same. So the particle is coming along to hit the wall. Now what happens? Well, it's a very complicated process. As the particle hits the wall, this function here is the probability density of the particle. It becomes very complicated. It acquires a lot of structure. But you notice the probability of being at the wall is always zero. Particle avoids the wall, and then out it comes again. So that's reflection of a quantum particle off a wall. And as I said, if the wall is negative, the particle bounces back. It doesn't fall into the abyss. And essentially, this mechanism, we've shown this mechanism, means that the universe heads towards the singularity. It sort of knows about the singularity well before it hits it. It has to, the mathematical theory you need needs to involve treating that instability well before you've hit it. And basically the universe gathers itself together and bounces back. One of the amazing things we found is this process of falling off the hill and bouncing back automatically leads to glassy perturbations. And there's a fundamental symmetry reason for that, which is the dual theory, the theory living on the boundary of space-time, is automatically scale invariant. Turns out the scale in gravity goes away. So this is a very different explanation than the inflationary one, but very interesting. The big caveat here I should emphasize, one of the assumptions, in fact, in this model is that there are four space dimensions instead of three. That turns out technically to be easier to study. But the same principle should apply in three, it's just that we haven't got the techniques to do that yet. Even if we can make a fully consistent model, we want to know if it's true. And the only way we'll convince ourselves of that is if there are observations which verify the model. So to end with, I just want to show you that actually the observations we need are closer than you might imagine. I mean, at first sight, you might say, well, how can I ever test whether the Big Bang was the beginning of time, as assumed in inflation, or a violent event in a pre-existing universe, as in the cyclic model? I mean, how can we test? But actually, there is a test, and there may well be more which we haven't thought of yet. The test which we know about is using gravitational waves. So these are ripples in space-time predicted by Einstein's theory of gravity, and they travel through space at the speed of light. Their beauty, and also the reason they're so hard to study, is they hardly couple to ordinary matter. they've coupled very weakly. So if a gravitational wave went through this room, we would be completely unaware of it because it has so little effect on the matter that it passes through. So ordinary matter and radiation are transparent to gravitational waves. They will just travel straight through. So that makes them very hard to detect, but it also means they're superb for looking back to the beginning of the universe, because they would come straight through that plasma. The plasma we cannot see through with light is completely transparent to gravitational waves. So if we can measure these gravitational waves, we will literally, and we look at the sky, we will be looking at the Big Bang singularity itself. So there's nothing that stops us seeing what happened at the Big Bang. So here are gravitational waves, and in our lifetimes, well, in fact, in the next 10 years, we're going to see these things measured routinely. There are a number of experiments all geared up to measure gravitational waves. The way in which they are so useful is that inflation, this period of exponential expansion in the beginning of the universe, which is assumed, during this period, it turns out that an automatic side effect is the production of gravitational waves. You can't avoid it. It's sort of like a very violent explosion has to emit sound waves. And the very violent epoch of expansion of the universe generates these gravitational waves. So they should be filling space. So if the universe had a period of inflation, the evidence is everywhere in this room. The room should be full of gravitational waves. The universe should be full of gravitational waves. And it turns out they're also scale invariant. So there's a wave of a certain strength on every length scale. There's sets of waves on every length scale in the universe. And what they do is they lead to a pattern, of a swirling pattern in the polarization of the sky. So I discussed this polarization before. Gravitational waves lead to a particular distortion of it, which is a subtle effect, but it should be there if inflation occurred. And so this is the satellite which will fly later this year, the Planck satellite. And that will be able to measure the swirling pattern from the simplest inflationary models. And so Stephen Hawking has made a bet with me. At least he made it. He makes lots of bets. But one of the bets he made was that the Planck satellite will see this evidence of inflation. And you know, if it does, then even I will accept that inflation happened. I think it'll be very, very strong evidence for inflation. But he's made that bet, and I accepted the bet for any amount of money at even odds. But he doesn't want to bankrupt me. And so he hasn't named an amount. But we have agreed that we will decide on something before the satellite flies. He also plans to go into space. And so I said, well, if I win, then I should go into space. But he didn't agree with that. So this hopefully will... it could be that the... evidence for inflation becomes very strong within the next year. If the satellite doesn't see the swirling pattern, unfortunately, inflation theory can be adjusted to avoid this prediction. And I'm sure a lot of people will do that. But when you start going down that road, it starts getting more and more ugly. I think it will be a count against inflation if this is not seen. This is an even more exciting experiment. In 2013, three satellites will be put in space, a million miles apart in a triangle. And basically, they will just, through laser interferometry, they will measure the distances between these satellites. And if a gravitational wave goes past, the distance changes, and you can detect that. And so using this, we hope to see signals from black holes colliding and all sorts of other things. And in the longer term, such experiments will be able to literally look back to the Big Bang and detect gravitational waves coming out of it from inflation or other sources. So that's all I wanted to say, except basically to reemphasize what I said at the beginning, that when, at least when I study these models, I don't, and I think this is something people find hard to understand, I don't necessarily believe any of them. That doesn't come into it. Belief doesn't come into it. What we try to do is develop models. We need ideas. We need models to examine. And then we try to test them as ruthlessly as we can. Are they really mathematically consistent? Are they? And then, of course, observationally, we try to test them. And in my view, that is actually the best way we have of appreciating the universe. We try our best to understand it. Maybe we won't succeed. But it's nevertheless a fantastic enterprise. And when we do understand something and something does agree with the model, it's a great feeling that actually we're getting a little bit closer to understanding reality and why we're all here. So that's sort of the way I see the subject. But I want to end on a sort of another positive note for Waterloo. Last night, we had an absolutely amazing event at Perimeter. Yo-Yo Ma and three young musicians were playing a concert, and it just blew us away. And of course, Perimeter, that's the goal of Perimeter too, is to reach the heights and blow everyone away with new discoveries about fundamental concepts in physics, which are so important. So I went home, and they'd lent me a BlackBerry. Okay, I have a very cheap mobile phone I use in England, and I try to keep it switched off as often as possible. But I had this BlackBerry, and I went back to the apartment I stay in, and I turn around. It has a balcony. I went out on the balcony, and I noticed my BlackBerry has a camera. And so I thought, okay, well, I'll just try taking a photo. So I took a photo of PI, and that's what I got, because there was a snowstorm. And you can see the lights coming out. That's the balcony I'm standing on. And I think that's what PI should be and will be. That I think what you've done here in Waterloo is absolutely unique. There's nowhere else in the world which has decided to form an institute devoted to pure physics, to the most challenging, difficult, exciting, and ultimately the most important ideas. And I just hope those ideas spread out from Perimeter, like in this picture. Thanks very much.
Period for our traditional question and answer session, and Sue and Julie will be coming right down to the front of the theater with the handheld microphones. I'll ask anybody with a question in about the next 10 minutes to raise their hand high. We'll pass you a microphone. Please stand up with a short question. Please keep it concise. So let's start right down here, the second row.
Okay. I got it. Great. Thanks for coming out. We really appreciate you having you here. And if you can say hello to Stephen for us, I'm sure we'll all appreciate that. My question has to do with the expanding universe.
Okay.
In recent, you know, studies have said that the universe is expanding and it's accelerating.
That's right.
And I was wondering if that acceleration has a relativistic effect, i.e., if we're expanding, is time slowing down? Is mass decreasing? And you know, or mass increasing, et cetera, et cetera. Because I feel the opposite. I think time is speeding up, and I think actually mass is decreasing because of that study they did with the kilogram losing weight. So I think the opposite is happening. So just wondering what you think about that.
I think all that's happening is that space is growing exponentially in size, and that's the main effect of dark energy or the cosmological constant.
Okay,
it's to cause expansion to blow up.
Okay, so we're not moving faster.
You could say you have to be very, very careful in relativity. you know, one of the things that's very confusing is if all of space is expanding, surely there's some point which is going faster than the speed of light away from me. And that is not true. I mean, in a sense it is, but this doesn't violate relativity. The expansion of space doesn't violate relativity. So you have to be very careful what you mean by things. And invariably, the only way really to define things is to think of a measurement that you could make and what is the outcome. And that you can clearly say what it is. And so I would say time is not really slowing down. I mean, if I sit here, imagine I can live forever. It would be nice. And I watch my clock, and it has an everlasting battery. well, I'll sit here and I won't be aware of anything much changing. Mm-hmm. But what will happen is all the galaxies we see on the sky will, as they move away from us, which they're doing now, they will become dimmer and dimmer, and actually also redder and redder, because distant objects are redshifted. And finally, they'll go out. And so we will be left all on our own in this expanding universe. And then what will happen is that the particles which make up our bodies will start to decay, because nothing is stable, ultimately. And so all the particles we're made of will ultimately decay into radiation. This will all be washed out by the expansion. And finally, there'll just be this vacuum of dark energy. That's the conventional picture, that you know we can see the end right now, because we see dark energy as important, and ultimately, it's going to wipe everything out. Right. So in the conventional picture, that is the future. In our picture, the dark energy is itself going to renew the process of bangs and so on.
Great. So we have a second chance.
Okay. Question
thanks.
Over here.
Okay. Thank you for the interesting talk. And when you talk about the Big Bang, it's very interesting. And I mean, it's logical and beautiful that say there's dark energy that causing the point-like universe getting unstable and then expand in a very exponential rate. But when we try to think about putting into numbers, things don't start to make sense, or things doesn't add up. Like when you mentioned about that the age of the universe is 13.7 billion years, right?
Yes.
You haven't mentioned that the size of the universe, that the scientists say is actually over 100 billion light years apart. And that comes to a problem here.
We don't know the size of the universe.
There was a lot of discussion that in the scientific community that the size of the universe is definitely over 100 billion light years apart, and that will come to a problem. That means does the size of the universe actually much bigger than light can travel in the lifetime of the universe, and. Well, then other scientists would say that actually, well, it's this expansion of the space that's causing the size of the universe. It's not the particles that are moving apart that fast to get the size of the universe. So now the problem is we don't understand time already. Like, so we have tried a hard time to understand time from the special relativity by Mr. Einstein. Now we don't even understand space. Because the space is actually bigger than what the light can travel. And now you also mentioned, okay, the Big Bang, maybe.
Just before you go any further, okay. I think there were reports that the universe is bigger than 100 billion light years. You have to always bear in mind that these reports are some kind of filtered interpretation of some scientific discovery. Now, what was going on there is physicists were trying to make models of the universe which were not infinite. Okay? In their models, the world, for example, was what we call a torus, a funny kind of space where if I travel out of one side, I would come back in the other side. And so people make mathematical models of the universe, and then they look at observations and try to prove those models wrong, or if they're lucky, prove them right. And what they discovered is those models have a parameter, which is the size of the torus. And that size had to be bigger than 100 billion light years. Otherwise, the sky wouldn't appear. You see, basically, they're corners. A torus, like if I live in a cube, it's not isotropic. They're special directions, which we don't see on the sky.
But it doesn't matter the size of it, because if whatever shape it is, it has to be bigger than 100 billion light years away somewhere.
Not true.
Okay.
That number applies to a specific set of models. And that is how we do the science. We try to make specific models. We try to prove them wrong. But you have to be very careful to interpret the statements as being more general than they actually are.
This is a bit of a conversation. Let's move back to some questions. Let's keep them very concise so we can reach as many people as possible, starting over here.
Two things. First of all, you mentioned at the end of the talk that there was an experiment for 2013 to put three satellites in orbit. Didn't President Bush cancel that recently?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Well, let's hope not anyway.
I think
it'll be long
survived.
Gone by then. That's a good news.
I think it survived.
Anyway, more interestingly, at the beginning of the talk, you showed some graphs from the WMAP observations.
Yes.
And I know that there's a question. The data points near the origin don't match the theoretical the theory. Can you comment on what's going on with the latest understanding
yes.
of this, please?
Yes, that's right. Let's just go back to that one. The point is these points here. Right?
Yeah.
So that doesn't look very good. But what you notice is there's a spread here. You see the gray region? That shows the spread in theoretical predictions. And that's what's called technically one sigma. And so basically, all the theory really predicts is that these numbers should be roughly within this band. And they can actually be slightly outside of it. So the spread in the predictions, you see, the real problem is we only have one universe to see. And the origin of the fluctuations in both theories, cyclic or inflation, is from quantum effects, which are only probabilistic. So they don't say you're going to see this patch over there, or you are definitely going to see a certain number. They just give a probabilistic prediction. And the probabilistic prediction has greater spread over here. So this number is there. I think it's about 2 sigma, meaning 1% probable. But you know, things happen. And so we live in a 1% probable universe. Is that something we should worry a lot about or not? So it's a difficult case. We're not quite sure. You know, in particle physics, they have a rule of thumb. Do not believe or take seriously any measurement unless it's 5 sigma. Okay. And so particle physicists would just laugh at us for worrying about this, because things, unlikely things happen all the time. Unfortunately, the real problem here is we only have one sky. If our, children and their children and so on are able to travel to another part of the universe and make a different picture, then they could, then we'd get more data. And this is the place where it's very, very hard to get more data, because we just live in one sky.
Okay, we have time for one last final question right here.
Sure. How does the work that's going to be done by the Large Hadron Collider fit in with everything you've just talked about?
Right. The LHC is really testing this picture. And the previous equation. The first equation I wrote down, okay, so here's gravity, electromagnetism, strong, weak force. Here is Dirac and all the particles, electrons, quarks. Here are their masses. Now, this is the shakiest part of the equation, okay? Notice there's more terms than any other. But this phi here is the Higgs field. And the Higgs field is added to these parts of physics are sort of very, very beautiful. This is the ugly part of what we know. This Higgs field is added in, and its role is to give all the particles their mass. This term gives them their mass, the electron, quarks, their mass. And this term describes the energy in the Higgs field itself. So this is the least certain part of the equation. And the primary role of the Large Hadron Collider is to detect the Higgs particle. And so if it does that, then it will measure the parameters in that in those terms. A lot of people, as I said, suspect this is not the final story because it has this 18 free numbers. And there are various other arguments why this is actually rather contrived. It has fine-tuning problems and so on. So people suspect that there is a simpler version which involves supersymmetry. And supersymmetry is a symmetry relating this term, Maxwell term, with Dirac. That according to supersymmetry, these are all one term. And so many people are hopeful that the LHC will discover evidence for supersymmetry. And that would be a really fundamental breakthrough in simplifying this equation and, you know, ultimately reducing the number of terms to a much simpler formula.
So with that, please join me in thanking Professor Turek for a wonderful lecture.
About the Institute and to enjoy other programs, visit us online at perimeterinstitute.ca.